Dean Anderson and members of the seminary community. I have been in educational administration now. I am only admitting and not boasting exactly 25 years. And one of the functions that has to be performed by the chief administrator of an educational institution from time to time is to do certain things, as for example, the conferring of academic degrees in absentia. So I feel very much at home here this afternoon addressing most of the students and faculty in absentia. I had felt, as a matter of fact, that if I had permitted Mr. Underwood to use the title I had first suggested, that there might be more here today. And the title I first suggested to him was Theological Education, an Old Man's Point of View. I seriously, however, do not in any sense object to the number of absentees, for I am frankly pleased to find as many as there are here this afternoon. I am reminded of an experience I had some years ago, for I had learned early in my administrative career that because I was president of an educational institution, I would get invitations to speak only because I was president of an educational institution. And I therefore was determined that I would never prejudge whether or not I ought to go and fulfill an invitation on the basis of the number of persons I might be expected to address. I was resolved, for example, in my role as a minister, if I was called upon to preach, that I would go to the smallest country pulpit relatively as often as I would go to a large city pulpit. I accepted one such invitation on an occasion, a Lenten service in a little country church, and there were present to worship in that hour 17 souls. At the conclusion of the service, one of the dear sisters approached me and said, "Oh, I'm so sorry that there were just this few out here tonight." I said to her, "My dear sister, it's quite all right with me. I'm used to preaching to small congregations and to large congregations." She said, "I know, but can't you preach better when the house is full?" This makes it possible for me to say that if you find my remarks this afternoon either not pertinent or uninteresting, it's just due to the fact that you could do better when the house is full. I want to talk informally to you on the subject of theological education as the president of this university sees it. I want to do it, as the dean has indicated, not because of any technical competence I could bring to it, but having, just because of my age, to be in the position where I can view it in a perspective in which it can't be viewed by any other person here. I see Dr. Lambden smiles broadly when I say that, but I have to remind him that it is true that we both go back to the same era in student days, but I've been here longer than he has as far as the administration of the seminary and the university are concerned. I was a student here at Drew, and I speak from that perspective, recalling those days with great interest and very high appreciation. Only want to make it, Dean, a matter of intrusion into this particular subject today to recall the fact that I had during my student days a church 12 miles beyond the city of Baltimore, of which church I acted as pastor. And I had to come back on Sunday night by a sleeper to get back to Drew at a required class Monday afternoon at 1:30. So when you're dealing with Monday afternoon classes, just for the sake of history, we had required classes back in those days. I confess I kept that church only a year. Because, as a matter of fact, I was paid just enough that when I paid my fare down and my sleeper back at night in order to get here in time for class, I had just $1 left over each week, which didn't make it a particularly remunerative situation. I speak also, I think it should be said, with the background of one who did teach in a theological school for a few years, over which for 3 other years he presided as the chief administrative officer. I must remind you, no, it would be inform you, because no one here can remember the fact that I came to Drew as dean of the theological seminary, in which position I failed so utterly that the president, who had invited me to assume the post, had to give in his resignation and offer his retirement to make way for the fact that I could be elected to the presidency. All of this is necessary for you to get the picture of the perspective that I myself am trying to give. I am very happy that the title of the Institution of Learning in which you are now studying is that of a theological school. I disclose my attitude toward the whole matter by saying that it has been my conviction all through the years that a theological school is basically what the name itself implies. It is a school of theology. I think indeed it might be well for us as we approach this to look back historically, in the matter of the education of ministry in this country from the earliest days. And I think as we understand this historic context, it will give us a greater appreciation of what our task is even in the world today. Everyone knows that the first institution of learning in America was Harvard College, which was founded in 1636. Very few persons remember that it was founded under the aegis of the church and with the primary purpose of educating men for the ministry of the Protestant Church in America. And that between the years 1636 and 1700, approximately 50% of all the men who graduated from Harvard College went into the ministry of Protestant Christianity. This, as a matter of fact, is a proud piece of history, something not peculiar to Harvard, but something which would typify any of the earliest colleges of America. We could take another nearby institution, Princeton, which was chartered in 1746 and began its career as an educational institution in the city of Elizabeth, then the town of Elizabeth, Elizabethtown, New Jersey. It was in the home of the Reverend Jonathan Dickinson, who was himself a man of great ability as a preacher, as a pulpiteer, and as a scholar. This was the man who was picked out to form this new school, whose basic purpose was the education of men for the ministry of that branch of Protestantism. Incidentally, the classes met in the manse of that Presbyterian church. The students who needed to be boarded were billeted there. The dining room of that private home was the place in which they ate. The bedrooms were the place in which they slept. The library of that pastor, that minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ, was the library of that school. It will not surprise you, unless you already know the fact, that the poor man died 3 months after the school opened. When I think in terms of the arduous routine of the president of a college or university in this day, I become sometimes a little bit numb with the variation of responsibilities, but always comfort myself that actually the task is even simpler now than it was in the earliest days. But out of this type of background, out of this type of education, it is true that the minister in the earliest years of the history of the American people was a man whose position in the community was secure not only as a proclaimer of the truth, but a man who was recognized because of his intellectual powers. A type of leadership that infected the community, which transcended the immediate area of his own religious interest, because he was a man of great influence in the early life of the American people. May I now jump to another observation? And sitting here in the presence of the professor of preaching, I would urge upon you the fact that what I have to say this afternoon should not be considered as a model for the association of materials which would fit into what you would call a discourse in the type of a sermon. I'm going to get you to jump around with me from thought to thought, hoping that when we get to the end, we will have arrived somewhere, even though we've taken a lot of short local journeys. You read in the newspaper on Monday of this week that the preacher at the Riverside Church delivered a sermon in which he bewailed the fact that there were so many of the laity of this country who knew so little about what Christianity really meant. He stressed the fact that Christianity, if the news report is correct, is considered by the average layman attending church as some indefinite type of idealism without any specific context and without any specific pattern. I draw this to your attention only because whatever one feels about a theological school must be related to the fact that we are living today in an age of great religious illiteracy. The encouragement we may get from the high attendance that we have in our church services and the rapidly increasing number of persons who ally themselves with the Christian church does not necessarily prove that there is a firmer grasp on the religious faith or a greater incorporation of this in the lives of the people to whom we administer. If I may quote from the book which Pratt wrote some 10 or 12 years ago, Can We Keep the Faith? And you will understand that a quotation from a book does not mean that the speaker necessarily endorses the full content of the book. He said in that book, it is true that most young people today are not unbelievers, because most young people today do not even know the beliefs which they do not believe. And I think there is a great element of truth in this. I think the religious illiteracy that we find on all hands is a religious illiteracy that reflects upon the leadership which the church gives in this day and age in the proclamation of those things which are basically part of the Christian revelation. It is due, I think, in part to the fact that particularly in Methodism, and this, I may say, is not something peculiar to Methodism, a church is an organization. And the man who heads the church is basically regarded as an administrator who must produce. This is part of the American idea of life anyway, that a man must be a producer. And if he is a good administrator and he can show the best statistics at the end of the year, he therefore has been the most creative man. I want to speak on this subject, and I can speak on it with the greatest of firmness, because there is no one here whose category of existence through the years has been more in the field of administration than has mine. And I may say also, despite the fact that this has been true, that I think the Apostle Paul was quite correct when he listed the preferential position of the various segments of those who are committing their lives to the propagation of the gospel, when he put the administrators next to last. Just ahead of the speakers in various kinds of tongues, and I have known of people who have associated administrators with those who speak with various kinds of tongues. But there is no question that the primary purpose of the church is fulfilled in the role of those who declare their position through the role of apostle and prophet and teacher. And I think we can say that the other things which are included in St. Paul's list, the natural aftermath of things that become necessary because we do have apostles and prophets and teachers, and that the role which befalls the minister of the gospel today is in the first instance a role that can be described as that of apostle and prophet and teacher rather than the others. I know the great satisfaction that is had when a man can stand in his pulpit on Sunday morning and realize that he has in attendance there some 500 or 600 persons. I might have been more comforted, as I've said previously today, Dean, if this place had been full this afternoon. I mean full of students. But I point out the fact that the most important thing that happens in any occasion in which a man declares himself is what happens within the intellectual and spiritual life of the person who hears what is being said. And the effectiveness that you will have here from month to month in whatever period you will sit down together as students and administration and faculty to deal with the issue of theological education is not dependent upon the number of persons who come out to hear. But it is dependent upon what happens in the mind and in the life of the persons who do come. And to me, this is of the utmost importance in our role as ministers of the gospel. I often wonder, I must confess to you, as I move from place to place, of what it is all about when men do have great organizations, fine budgets, tremendous interest within the church as an organization. I wonder what happens in the proclamation of truth, what change takes place in the thinking and in the lives of the persons who are seated in houses of worship. I put it down, therefore, as of first and foremost importance, so far as the role of the minister of the day is concerned, that his interest should not be primarily in statistics, should not be primarily in organization. Now, mind you, it's hard for me to say this. I am an administrator, and I've got to look for statistics. We're in a quadrennial program, and I've got to look for tens and tens and tens of thousands of dollars from the churches. All of this is important for me as an administrator, talking to persons who are administrators, heads of local churches. But all of this is of no importance whatsoever unless the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ is being proclaimed, unless men and women are being brought into conformity to the truth of the gospel, so that they are not conforming to this world, but they are being transformed by the renewing of their minds. What happens on Sunday morning, what changes take place in the lives of the people who come, and what changes take place in the community in which the man administers, these are the real things and the things of highest importance. And it seems to me that whatever we accomplish in a theological school, it must bring us to the end where we recognize this type of responsibility and we fulfill it to the highest within us. And whatever type of education is presented at Drew Theological Seminary, it should be the kind of education which makes us constantly and continuously students who are constantly and continuously learning. I have had shocks in time past when I have greeted former students of mine and I have said to them, as I am wont to say, as they tell me about the work that they're doing in their local church, what are you reading? I am absolutely amazed sometimes to have them say to me, well, as a matter of fact, I just don't get time to read anything until it comes to Saturday and I have to whip together a sermon for Sunday. I recall with great chagrin a young man in whom I'd had the highest hopes as a student of New Testament Greek, the best student I think I had ever had. Now, this is a reflection on my teaching, I know, but I saw him about 5 years afterwards and he said that he didn't read the Greek New Testament anymore. And I followed this man with great interest, because he's an awfully nice chap. And he's must have done pretty good work all through the years, because they're gonna make him a district superintendent this year. So he's reached the apex of glory. Please don't misunderstand me. I have the very highest regard for the office of the superintendency, and I think there's no man within the Methodist organization that has a more difficult job to fulfill than does he. But our success in the ministry does not depend upon us obtaining positions that seem to give us distinction. There is no particular honor that falls anyone because in the routine of chance and circumstance, he gets a post of administrative importance. I assure you that the president of this university has no sense of this consciousness. For as a minister of the gospel, he feels as he thinks all ministers should feel, that their chief role is fulfilled as they interpret themselves as good ministers of Jesus Christ in whatever capacity they have. And this capacity must relate itself to the intellectual and the spiritual development of the individual who is concerned. Let me look now, if I may, Mr. Dean, for a few moments at an analogy. It's rather interesting, I think, that only in a school of theology, so far as I know, of any of the graduate professional schools, would student body and faculty be sitting down together to talk over the question of what ought to be taught in a theological school, in that school. Could you, by any stretch of imagination, think of a medical school and the students sitting down with the faculty to try to discuss together what it is they ought to study, or in a law school? This is a type of democracy which belongs only in the realm of religion, and I would think also only in the realm of Protestant religion. But if we may use the analogy of the medical school, may I call your attention to the fact that the first thing that the medical student does when he goes to his school of advanced learning is to take the stiffest, toughest, meanest kind of a course in human anatomy that you could ever think about. He's thrown into an area of study that seems to be so remote from the ultimate objective of what he's doing that he very often becomes greatly disturbed and greatly disheartened. I know this to be true because I know very well a student who went through this routine. And I remember also the nights through which he went without ever going to bed to study the data that had to be assembled in the field of anatomy and physiology and histology. Assembling this tremendous store of knowledge and the awkward terms applied to it. And I know how on more occasions than one, he would almost sweat with the hope that the day would come almost on the morrow when he could be doing the kind of things that he had to do when he became a practicing physician. And he could not at that time see the relationship between the difficulty of what he was doing and the ultimate thing that he was going to do. But I can also testify that this same young man is one of the happiest practicing physicians I know because he gave himself diligently to that and understood fully when he had completed the cycle of his medical education the importance of things to him which at the time in which he was going through them he did not in fullest sense at least appreciate. May I use this analogy, therefore, for the benefit of our own curriculum here, for the benefit of our own philosophy of education here. I know that it is true that you are given certain areas of study in the theological school that are very perplexing to you and sometimes very disturbing. I will say to you that my first year in theological school was to me personally a very upsetting year. I learned some ideas that I just never thought existed. And these ideas were making their attack upon the relatively simple idea of religion and faith that I had. And I know that this is very often true when you go into the intricacies and the involvements of theological discussion, that you may find yourselves at certain areas wondering what this is all about. I do feel, however, that all of this is not only basic, but absolutely necessary to the minister who goes out, and I'm speaking about the parish ministry, to declare the truth of Jesus Christ, that this kind of knowledge is as necessary, as indispensable to him in the background of what he's trying to do, than is the background study in anatomy and physiology and histology to the student of medicine who at the time cannot see the sense of all of this, but who would never be an effective practicing physician unless he had it. This does not necessarily mean, indeed I should like, if I may, to give a word of caution at this particular point, that the student is going to rush from the classroom to his pulpit to declare from the pulpit what he's heard in the classroom. I think one of the very distinctive problems we have in the ministry within the church today is that problem of declaring the truth of God in its utmost simplicity, but to do it out of the background of those who understand fully what it is necessary to have as groundwork in the declaration of these truths. I think, as a matter of fact, that the truly effective man in the ministry today is the man who can proclaim the truth of God as is revealed in Jesus Christ and can do it with a simplicity, the kind of simplicity that St. Augustine declared when he said, make the truth plain, make the truth pleasing, make the truth moving. But let us always bear in mind that it is the truth that we are to make plain. It's the truth we are to make pleasing. It's the truth we are to make moving. And we as ministers of the gospel must always forget ourselves and think only of Christ, whom we are exalting. That our end and objective is not to speak in such a way that our congregations may be pleased, but to speak the truth in such a way that they may be pleased to accept it and to do it. This, I grant you, is no small charge to us. And those of us who are given to this should bear in mind that the end result of what we are doing, as I have said, is not to be found in the statistics of our accomplishment. I warn you also to understand that it is not to be found in the complimentary things that your parishioners say when they greet you at the door of the church at the end of the service. There isn't anything that can be quite so deceptive to a young man in the ministry is to believe what members of your congregation tell you at the end of a service. If they say to you, Pastor, that was a good sermon this morning, you understand that that is only a figure of speech and another way of their saying, if it had been raining today, I would not have come to church. And if they say to you, that was a very interesting sermon this morning, Pastor, you must understand that that's only another variety in the way they say to you, good morning, how are you today, Pastor? They've got to say something to you. And don't be encouraged by the complimentary things they say about you. And don't be discouraged when they say absolutely nothing to you. For the effectiveness of your ministry is not the effectiveness which is declared to you by the complimentary things that may be said to you to your face. But the effectiveness of your ministry is to be discovered only as your people are brought into the conformity to the basic concept of the gospel of Jesus Christ. So I say to you, there is within me a great conviction that we must put first and foremost in our theological curricula what we have constantly spoken of in academic circles as the content work. This does not mean that there are not other areas that need to be taught. And I wish, in getting the historical perspective before you, to stress the fact that there is more practical work, more applied work, more work in that area now taught in Drew Theological Seminary than has ever been taught in the history of the school. If we may go back to these antediluvian days, which would include Dr. Lambton and myself, I would point out the fact that the only thing of a so-called applied nature that we had in those days was in the general area of what was then called practical theology. You probably didn't know that there was both a practical and an impractical theology, but that was the area in which we were taught. In that day, as a matter of fact, religious education was coming into the picture. It was in the earliest periods. But religious education in that day was a course, really, in religious psychology. The applied end of it was in itself not a very important part of it. But we studied, as the course was called, that I remember I took, the psychology of the Christian soul. And I think it should be said that within the past 8 years, there has been a far larger increase in the number of courses that are to be described as belonging to this applied field than we have ever had in any period in the history of Drew Theological Seminary. There is one thing that you can learn to do when you get out into a parish. You can learn to be an administrator. You can learn how to do a great many things in the operational life of your parish. But I doubt very much if you are not a biblical student by the time you get there, if you're not a theologian by the time you get there, that you'll have no chance to start that business then. And I think, if I may say this, Mr. Dean, that students, and I have gotten very largely out of the realm of historical perspective, students who fail to recognize that we cannot now teach everything in a theological school that will fit every situation in which you will find yourself when you get into a local parish. You cannot get answered in advance the questions that you need to have answered when you become the administrator of a local parish. There is a tremendous area that I choose to call just plain common sense that you'll have to use and adapt to the situations that arise there. But I would say that you will be lost as a servant of Jesus Christ unless when you go there you have a message, and unless this message is predicated on the basic truths of the Christian revelation. I have used this illustration in another connection before, and I trust that there are enough students here today who haven't heard it who would be willing to listen to it. I talked a few years ago to an attorney who naturally looked upon the ministry as an attorney would. And I would say that what he was saying to me, he was saying critically of the ministry. And I do resent it whenever a layman gets critical of a preacher. We love to criticize ourselves, and it's all right for us to do that. But I don't like the laity to be critical of us. And this man was unjustifiably critical. But even in his criticism, he said something that was profoundly true, namely this: a minister must remember that he is not a commentator, he is an advocate. And I've remembered that in the intervening 10 years because it impressed itself so greatly upon my mind. Your congregation may be interested in what you have to say on Sunday morning. But if what you say on Sunday morning is only what you have to say, in the sight of Almighty God, it isn't worth the proverbial tinker's dam. When you speak on Sunday morning, you speak on authority. And that authority is the revelation of Jesus Christ, which revelation you should know and to the utmost of your capacity should comprehend. And I feel that the curricula that we have in theological schools should be the curricula which would give us this undergirding, which will make us think and work, but which will give us the foundation stone on which a whole ministry may be based. Mr. Dean, I don't know whether there are moments left in which anyone would want to ask a question, but I would not be adverse to that should there be. Well, I suppose they feel, since the members of their parish can't talk back to them on Sunday morning, they shouldn't talk back to me on a Wednesday afternoon.